Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
And welcome to another wonderful evening of broadcasting here on LA Talk Radio. This, of course, is The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, and I am on the phone and in studio with my good friend and dear, dear, dear co-host is Bobby Jean Bell.
Hey, I'm here in snowy Albuquerque.
Oh, and I can see you.
I know. Our cameras on.
I know. I'm going to start calling you Doris because that's how she used to film her through gauze and Vaseline.
I know. I have to clean that lens. I actually have another little camera I usually put up there, but we've never really done this way. So I don't lipstick on nothing. You know, I'm made for radio.
Yes, I actually have the face for radio, as our guest will attest, because he saw me the other night. So, I mean, yeah, he can say, yeah, he does. We have a great guest tonight. As a matter of fact, we're gonna run through the BS real quick because I want to get John on the air with us.
Get in the book.
He has written a phenomenal. This is, I believe, his fourth book in his series, fifth book. And see, I can see John and I can see Bobby. They can't see me. Knock, 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 knock. Okay. Well, let's get right into it, Bobby. Mr. John Dudakis is a journalist, he's a novelist, and he's a writing coach, and he's a former senior copy editor on CNN's The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer. Dudakis is the author of five novels to the Lark Chadwick Mystery Suspense Thriller Series. His fourth novel, Bullet in the Chamber, is a winner of Reviewer's Choice, Forward Indies, and Feathered Quill Book Awards. His most recent novel, Fake, is a winner of the 2020 Reviewer's Choice Award in Fake. Lark is a White House correspondent dealing with fake news in the era of Me Too. Dudakis, a former White House correspondent, regularly teaches novel writing at literary centers, writers' conferences, and bookstores around the country and abroad. In his spare time, Dudakis is also a jazz drummer. Oh, I love it. But don't boom, boom, boom. Okay, will you please welcome to the Writer's Block, Mr. John Dudakis.
Hi, thank you.
Hi. How are you? Good to see you. And I actually can.
I see Bobby, so that's plenty.
Yeah, that'll work. What the hell? So this book you've written, I mean, as soon as I read the title, which only took me a second because it's one word, Fake, it immediately conjured up, and why, I don't know, but it did. It conjured up, well, because there's been so much talk about it, fake news. And, I mean, nothing else is labeled as a fake anymore other than the news. So it had to be the news. And I understand where you got the title, but how did you figure out you wanted to put Lark in this kind of a scenario?
Well, thank you very much, and it's especially appreciative that you've actually read the novel.
Yes,
that takes dedication, and I know a lot of reviewers and interviewers don't do that. So thank you very much for
doing that.
And I mean, Lark and I have been. In a relationship probably for the last 15 years. It took me 10 years to get the agent that I've got and the publisher. So the first novel that I wrote came out in about 2005, Fast Track. So I've been with Lark for a number of stories, and Fake came along when I got the idea when Trump was elected president. And the reason that I started to write the book, is that I was troubled that he was calling reporters the enemy of the American people. And I worked in journalism for 45 years, and unlike what some presidents will tell you, it is a firing offense at a reputable news organization to make things up. So I wanted to put Lark in a situation where she is the victim of fake news, because it's important for us to have information we can trust, and that is now evaporating. And there are consequences to that when you start besmirching someone's character unfairly and falsely. And so the book is not meant to be an anti-Trump polemic, because truth is not no party has a corner on the truth. But I wanted to show in my novels what it's like behind the scenes, because I'm coming across people who, cuss me out for being part of fake news, but they don't know anything about journalism. They don't know how it's done. And so I've always tried in all my novels, to put Lark in a situation where people will get a real feel, not only for what it's like to be a journalist, but what it's like to be a female journalist.
Well, the prologue it starts the novel out. I mean, it starts the novel out. I mean, let's just face it. I mean, the First Lady of the United States pulls an "I'm dead" and just out she goes on the floor.
Well, you get us from page one, and I don't think I took a breath until I got to the end of the book.
Yeah, but all the way through the book, you're wondering, now is she really dead?
I know. I started asking.
No spoiler alerts. No spoiler alerts, John. Yeah. We're good with that.
Right. But like you're saying, Jim, I was reading, and we always like to think we're readers, but we also know we're going to be talking to the author. And I always like to think about that title, and why? And I wasn't very far into the book when I thought, wait, this is called fake. So what is going to be fake, if any, and how is that going to be discovered? And you had me, John. I couldn't put it down.
I appreciate that. That means a lot. Thank you, because I know you read a lot.
Well, yeah, we do. We read a book a week, and the truth is that we read a lot of really good books. I mean, there's no doubt. But we very rarely ever get a book that grabs us by the gonads from page one and runs us all the way through to the end. And this one did. It's like I told Bobby just before we got a hold of you tonight, was that this book, I mean, the last quarter of this book was insane. It just was. I mean, you must have been like on drugs when you were writing this last quarter of this book, because it was so much going on. It's really hard to keep track of it all.
Well, drug was caffeine.
Well, and it's so well written that it's really hard to stop reading it, truly.
Well, so, I mean, thank you.
So, John, you're not a tea drinker? We just throw that in
not
there.
Really,
not a tea drinker.
Not really. I've been known to drink it, but it doesn't have the same kick.
Tea has a little, there's a little reason to make a comment about tea. Read the book.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's like taking aspirin next to Celebrex. Aspirin does the job. Celebrex kicks your ass. Ask me, I'll tell you.
John, I have one of the questions that I have, and thank you for giving us some questions. I don't know. I have some that are not on the list. This is a series, and I'm eager to read the other books, but it is obviously standalone. And yet you've been writing this series for a while. How has she aged over the time? Like, do these books actually take place really quickly in her life? That's the question.
That's a really good question. The series has been in existence for 15 years, but I would say that in actual time in Lark's life, it's only been maybe 3 years. But it's like every 6 months, there's, something new happens in her life.
Right.
And I zero in on that. But her character does change in that she starts out basically, she's impulsive. impulsive. She is she's prone to anger issues. She's dropped out of college because she was almost raped by her English professor. So the very first book is when she is vexed because she doesn't really know what to do with her life. And she's, you know, dropped out of school to write the great American novel, which keeps getting rejected because it's an anti-male screed. And so she's pretty down in the dumps. And so the series begins when she discovers the body of the aunt who raised her from infancy because her parents had been killed in a car accident. And so she goes to the small town where the accident happened, gets the newspaper clipping, and discovers to her astonishment that she's the miracle baby who survived a car train collision, but no one had ever told her. So she convinces the newspaper editor, Lionel Stone, to let her do a follow-up story. Two of the characters are the mayor and the sheriff. They're running against each other for Congress, and each guy has a secret that will unravel the mystery. And so so she goes into journalism and changes in that she's got to toughen up because, you know, people lie to journalists all the time. It's not usually the other way around. Journalists are doing the lying. They're the ones trying to check out the story to find out if it's true because everybody's spinning them. And so she evolves based on primarily a lot of trouble that happens, a lot of grief that happens. People that are important to her die. And so she really comes to grips with the loss, and as she, the losses, and as she does, she grows as a person as well.
Jim, can I just follow up on
Bobby, you never have to ask.
Well, I know you've got all kinds of things. I know you're going to ask too.
I do.
I know. Okay, so I'll just ask this sort of as a follow-up.
Okay, sure.
Jim, you and I, you know, we have read a lot of different books that are parts of series. And so it's interesting because we generally only get to read one in the series. You, I think, as her backstory, without doing it as a kind of a dump, you know,
right.
She's seen a grief counselor, and in those, that's sort of the way that you use as a mechanism to allow us to hear about, like, what you all just shared, which is why I want to read those books. How do you kind of keep track of the backstory? Like, the next book, will you make references in the next book to what happened in Fake? Will you continue each book to give us some of her history?
I do. I mean, I write them so that they stand alone, but I do exactly what you've noticed, and that is, you know, give a hint of things that came before without giving away those stories per se. And I haven't really started writing this novel yet, but answered that question yet. I want to dump in, you know, a few facts that will help keep the reader oriented to who Lark is, but I may leave some things out because now we're talking about the sixth book. That could be a pretty long backstory, and I want to avoid that.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm done with my two most important questions. Well, I have another one, but that's for later. You can have him now, Jim. He's all yours.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a real quick one, then we're going to have to go to a real fast break. Do you find it hard to write first person as a woman?
You know, I don't. Not as hard as I thought it would be. When I first started, someone suggested that I should write in a way that stretches who I am. And I'd never been a woman, at least not in this life, so I thought I'd give it a try. And I discovered that it wasn't as difficult as I thought, because I most have the exact same emotions. It's just that in my experience, the women in my life have been more articulate about their emotions, more nuanced about them, and more willing to share them. So I just found that I would take myself and put a skirt on it and write that character. Although one woman asked me at a book signing, she said, "What do you wear when you write?"
Great question, actually.
Great question.
It was a great question. And the answer is jammies. So you're not going to really get that. No high heels.
Oh, come on. Hey, we're going to take a real quick break here, John. Don't go away. Stay with us, please. And if this is LA Talk Radio, you're listening to The Writer's Block. I'm your host, Jim Christina. And we'll be right back with you with author John Dedekis right after this word from LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Talk Radio. You're listening to LA Talk Radio's very own The Writer's Block, and I am your host, Jim Christina. And you know, in this time of COVID-19, when everybody is locked down and working from home, getting tired of that old terrestrial AM talk radio stuff and TV, how about this? How about you log on to LA Talk Radio? See, we've got some of the best talk, music, sports, self-help, and, you know, just about anything that your little heart desires right here at LA Talk Radio. So why go any further? Why not just sit back and listen to what our hosts and our shows have to tell you? So that's LA Talk Radio, and it's found at latalkradio.com, and listen to The Writer's Block every Thursday night, 6 p.m., right here on LA Talk Radio.
And we are back in the studio with writer John Dedekis and, of course, Bobby Jean Bell. And if you want to call and talk to John, and I'm sure some of you do, the number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. Again, that number is, and Bobby says, get a pencil, 323-203-0815. John, if you wouldn't mind, would you kind of give us a brief introduction into your book, Fake?
Well, let's see. As you've already given a sense of what happens in the very beginning. Lark is right. A White House correspondent, as she was in the previous book, Bullet in the Chamber. And she's covering President Will Gannon, who is in his very first 100 days or so of his administration. She covered him when he was governor of Georgia, when she was a newspaper reporter. And so now she has gone to the Associated Press. And in the previous book, she experienced a loss, and the president and his wife were very kind to her. And the First Lady and Lark are collaborating on an autobiography that the First Lady intends to write. And as part of the interview process, during the interview, the First Lady drops dead. And so that really launches the book. And at the same time, Lark becomes, in a sense, the victim of a conspiracy theory, I guess you could say. And if you don't mind, can I read a little bit from it?
Absolutely. We were going to ask you to, so please feel free.
This takes place about, I don't know, two-thirds of the way into the book. I'm not going to give away any plot information, but it gives you a sense of what it can be like to be a reporter on the receiving end of fake news. By this time, we know that the allegation is that Lark is having an affair with the president. We, as the reader, know that it's not true. So Lark is sitting at an outdoor cafe journaling, and she notices this guy. The guy at the table, smirking at me, looked to be about 50 and extremely fit, definitely my type. But I wasn't in the market and had too many more other pressing issues to deal with. Are you a practitioner of automatic writing? The guy asked, taking a sip from a glass of what looked like iced tea. Excuse me? You were writing like a fiend, not even pausing to think. Oh, yeah, I laughed. I was writing in my journal. I'm trying to sort out some stuff that's going on in my life. You must be having one hell of a life. Oh, you could say that. The name's Jake. He reached over to shake my hand. I gave his fingers a squeeze. Nice to meet you, Jake. You live around here? Nah, I was just in the area visiting a friend. You, I asked? I live back over there, he nodded vaguely behind me. As I paid my bill and packed up my stuff, I took stock of him. He wore a hunter green T-shirt, which he filled out nicely, khaki shorts and sandals, no socks. His thick salt and pepper hair was raffishly unkempt and curled at the ears and on the back of his neck. He was deeply tanned, except for a narrow strip of white skin on his ring finger. Well, it's been nice meeting you, Jake. I didn't catch your name. I didn't throw it. He laughed. I like your sass. Let me guess, it's Jennifer. Nope, nice try. Seems like every hot chick I've been meeting lately is named Jennifer, he said. I suppose. You look vaguely familiar. Have we met, he asked. I shook my head. I don't think so. I never forget a face, especially one as pretty as yours. He probably thought he was racking up cool points with me, but Jake was striking out badly and didn't know it. I smiled perfunctorily and turned my attention to signing the check and stuffing my credit card and laptop back into my messenger bag. Jake kept studying me, genuinely vexed that he couldn't place me. Seems to me I've seen you on television. Are you famous? More like infamous, I said without thinking. What do you do? He pressed. What do you do? I found that the best way to take the focus off myself is to shift the spotlight onto the other person. In my experience, people like to talk about themselves, and this guy was no exception. Mostly I work out and count my money, he laughed. I highly recommend retirement. Where'd you retire from? I asked. The United States Marine Corps, 2 tours in Afghanistan. Thank you for your service. You are entirely welcome, he dipped his head gallantly. And at last count, how much money do you have? It was a test question. Most normal people would be offended, but I suspected that Jake would relish the opportunity to brag. He puffed out his chest. At last count, a few mil, give or take. Seems like, you made your millions in the Marines? He shook his head. Had my own company after I got out and then sold it for a nice chunk of change. Capitalism is the best. Well, Jake, it's been... I just figured it out, Jake said, his face brightening. What's that? You, what's her name? The president's girlfriend. Now I was intrigued. What gives you that impression? It's all over the internet. He dug into his pocket, extracted his cell phone, and did some serious scrolling. Here it is. He thrust his phone toward me so I could see the screenshot of the president with his hand on my shoulder. You're Lark Chadwick, Miss Fake News herself, he said proudly. So glad to have made your day, I stood. Me too. Say, is he any good in bed? I think we're through here, Jake. Hell, we're just getting started. His expression darkened and hardened. Why do you liberal media types hate this country so much? You don't even know me, Jake. Oh, I know your type. While I'm getting shot at in Afghanistan, you're banging the president, as his wife is dying, no less. I should have walked away. Instead, I took a deep breath, pulled my chair over to his wrought iron table, sat down, folded my arms on top of the table, and leaned toward him. A minute ago, you're trying to pick me up, I said, trying to impress me with how rich you are, trying to flatter me about how hot I look. And then, when you realize I'm a journalist, you judge me based on information that's not even true. But do you even... He grabbed me by the forearm and squeezed so hard it hurt. Ow! He stuck his face in front of mine, lowered his voice, gritted his teeth, and hissed, listen to me, you stuck-up snowflake little bitch. In Afghanistan, I killed better people than you. Let go of me, I demanded. My stern, he tightened his grip. You need to be taught a lesson. His eyes were wild, crazed. I'll stop there.
You rascal. You wear a skirt when you're writing this.
That's such a great passage. I think one of the things that I enjoyed as a reader is you really do give us a world that, unless we've ever been a journalist or, you know, reported news, we really don't know whether we're up on Air Force One or we're at a dinner or later on in the last part of the book when we're testifying. You really take us into that world. And I felt like I was seeing true glimpses of what that world is like, you know, in the beginning when she's with Rose and it's not really a spoiler alert. It happens so quickly. Rose kind of goes down and she pulls out her camera, her phone, and she's really betwixt in between, isn't she? Do I talk a little bit about that?
Because
I'm sure that has to be a dilemma for journalists. When they put the journalist hat on versus I'm just out and about, and how do you make that decision about what you capture and then what you share?
Yeah, that's the difference between a professional and an amateur, because the professional journalist just knows that You can't be emotional. You've got to put your emotions aside. You've got to put your opinions aside. And you've just got to dig into the story and follow the truth wherever it may be. Photojournalists have an especially difficult time because they are photographing people usually in the worst moment of their life. Mm-hmm. And it's like being a vulture. And yet, as difficult as that is from a human perspective, it's history. And so that's the way the journalist approaches it. It's the first draft of history. And when I was a reporter, I mean, this was back in the days of film. It was before the internet, before cell phones. So I didn't have a lot of the luxuries that Lark has as a reporter. So if the first lady had dropped dead in front of me, you know, I would have just had to watch and take notes and get to a phone. And in her case, you know, in that now, reporters have the ability to go live wherever they are, and take pictures and go live stream. So we live in an entirely different world where there are no editors, there are no filters when it comes to the internet.
Do you find yourself, putting on your reporter hat again, do you find yourself wanting to be back in the older days, or do you find yourself kind of pining to be in the newer times when you can pick up your cell phone and make a video or immediately connect with your studio?
I don't miss the old days because, I mean, I would have loved to have had the internet and to be able to do a lot of research that way. I would have loved to have stayed in the field and not had to get the film back at 2 p.m. in order to get it developed so that it would make the evening news.
Right.
So there's a lot to be said for the instantaneousness of it.
Okay. Can we switch topics here probably for the rest of the show? The book is fake. If you haven't read it, please pick it up. Available wherever you find books, and I'm sure from John's website as well, and Amazon for sure, and wherever books are sold online, and probably in bookstores. So pick up a copy and read it. You will not be disappointed. In fact, any of the Lark Chadwick books, pick those up. You'll be dealing with a very fine author, and this book is phenomenal.
Thank you very much.
I know that you teach writing, mm-hmm. and as we spoke on Tuesday that this show is geared towards new writers. Mm-hmm. What can you offer new writters as far as tidbits of information that you were willing to share? Because not all writers are willing to share a lot of their stuff, but I mean, it's stuff that you are willing to share as a teacher. To a new writer who's listening to this show, and there are a lot of new writers that do listen to the show, so the floor is yours.
Well, I love talking to new writers or people who've never really tried it before, but they've got this hankering to, you know, write their story or get into print. I really like to fan that ember of creativity because there's a reason that you have this desire to write. And even if you're not trained as a writer, that's fine because you probably, I'm just guessing here, you've probably had conversations with other people. And
right.
You know what? That's in essence what writing is all about. It is communicating one-on-one with another person. You don't have to be fancy. You don't have to be literary. You just have to be able to tell a good story. And my guess is that you have probably told all kinds of stories, anecdotes, jokes, whatever. So you already know how to do this, but just don't get self-conscious about it. Just tap into your story and start to write it. And then as you do, you'll probably discover, oh my God, it's overwhelming. I don't know what I'm doing. Okay. Then start cultivating, you know, start teaching yourself how to do that. Probably the best resource is writersdigest.com. It's a fabulous resource online. They have they publish a market guide. They publish a directory of literary agents. They publish books on writing, craft, business, all the details. It's just there's no end to the things you can learn and teach yourself once you realize what you don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great answer, actually.
Thank you.
A little question. I think that the first time I asked this was last week. And because every book has got typeface, and every typeface is, I mean, you pick up some books that the typeface is like six, you know, it takes a magnifying glass to read it. And then, but most of the books coming out now are in 12 point, and most of them are in Times New Roman, which I believe, being a writer, I think that's probably the easiest font for people to actually read. And 12 point is probably the absolute best size for people to read. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, Times New Roman 12 point double space, that's the industry standard for writing a manuscript.
Right.
But every publisher has their own standard for, you know, what fonts they're going to use and all that. To a certain extent, it depends on how many words the book is.
Right.
So publication and the, you know, the finer points of how many pages it's going to be, production costs. So font size will probably, you know, be smaller if you have a big book. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's really out of my pay grade. And I just like, and you know, on my Kindle, I goose it so that it's nice and big oh, print. You know, I don't want to.
Thank
squint.
You so much. I'm half yeah. blind. I can't read most yeah. of those
I gotta
books.
Have big print.
Yeah, exactly. We're gonna break for just another real quick break. And don't go away, John. Please stay with us. And this is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block, and we'll be right back with author John Dedekis right after this word from Out West.
Readers wanted. Want tonight's featured title, Fake, by John Dedekis, or any books by the Writer's Block featured authors? Easy. Just go to outwestshop.com. Choose books and CDs from the toolbar, and from the drop-down menu, click Shop Out West on bookshop.org. The Writer's Block book list features titles of our guests. Click a book cover for the link to the interview and to purchase. Explore all our book categories. We add new titles daily, and Christmas and holiday gift giving is around the corner. One-stop shopping supports Out West and independent booksellers when you purchase books through our bookshop.org affiliate website. Remember, it's always a great day Out West.
Indeed it is. And we are back with Bobby Jean Bell and, of course, her Out West dad. She's just great. She and her husband, Jim, have owned that place for a long time. And she's just become such a good friend. But Mr. Dedekis, you are happy that you were able to be with us tonight.
Thank you. I'm having fun.
Oh, good. I'm glad you are. What is your opinion of self-publishing?
You know, self-publishing wasn't really around when I first started writing. I mean, there was Vanity Press, but it's much more well-developed now.
Yes.
And so there are, you know, I don't think there's as much shame as there used to be going into a self-published approach. I mean, there are something like 80,000 books a day that are published. I mean, the competition is crazy. And I would encourage, what I usually encourage my students to do is to approach their writing as if they're going to try to get published traditionally with an agent, because then your writing will go up to a professional level, and it will mean that your book, even if you do decide to self-publish, it'll be a step ahead of the quality of a lot of self-published books. Because, you know, I think too often people get impatient, they want to get their book out there. And you can. I mean, that's one of the great things about self-publishing.
Right.
If you want to get your book out there, you can upload it to Amazon today. But it could be riddled with typos. It may be flabby. But that's okay. It's a book.
Right.
So I'm not against self-publishing, but I think that you need to understand that if you go the self-publishing route, it won't get into most bookstores because it won't be returnable. So right. Your reach will be limited. And you'll have to do your own marketing, which is also the case even with traditionally published books.
Right, right. Yeah, we tell people that all the time. As a matter of fact, we talk about self-publishing. We talk about independent publishing. And now we talk about independent publishers, of which there are a lot. And some of them do great jobs. Some of them do mediocre jobs. And some of them I wouldn't talk to. Mm-hmm. We happen to We happen to have a small publishing company here, and it's a Tuscany Bay Books, Black Dog Publishing. And we're very select in what we take, and we work it infinitesimally. We go through a book line by line, item by item, word by word, punctuation by punctuation. We put out anthologies. We put out a lot of different types of books, but we're very, very, very picky about what we do take. But then, see, we help with the marketing. We help with the, the printing. We help with all of that to get the author out there. A lot of companies won't do that. So I'm glad to hear that your attitude is not one of pure hate or revolution.
No, not at all. No. I'm working on a memoir now, and I went to my agent and I said, "So, what do you think?" And she said, "I think you ought to self-publish that."
Well, why not?
Yeah. And I mean, look, yeah. I teach people about getting an agent, and I'm also having to talk more about self-publishing. So I think if I do self-publish it, it'll give me a much better feel for what that side of the house is like.
Sure. Sure. And you know, as we spoke the other night, I mean, every book needs an editor. I mean, it doesn't matter whether, and never try to be your own editor unless, it's your first page. You just get so wrapped up in trying to fix something, you never finish it, number one. And number two, if you make a mistake and you're self-editing yourself, you're probably going to gloss right over the mistake you made because you made it to start with, And if you get somebody who's not interested in you and interested in just doing the job that they're paid to do, which I always advise you pay your editor. Don't get anybody to do it for free.
Yeah.
And get beta readers.
Beta readers, they'll do it.
And we talked about this too, which is a service that a lot of people don't know about, and yet a lot of people don't use them that do know about them. So why don't you give me a word about beta readers? Let our Rothers on the line know about beta readers and what they are.
Beta readers are probably the best kept secret in editing because these are people who love you, know you, you've been telling them about your novel, and they are just itching to get their hands on it.
Right.
And, they typically get a cheap way because you don't have to pay them, take them to dinner or something like that. But, these are people who you need. It's probably best if you don't share a bed or a last name with them because they'll either break your spirit or they'll be so complimentary that they won't be any good.
Right.
You need a beta reader, probably three, let's say, just for starters, three people who will read your manuscript and tell you what's wrong with it, what's not working. These were people who will reflexively tell you good things about it because they're nice people. But you need to give them permission to tell you what's not working, and then you need to listen to what they say. If they say, I didn't understand what was going on page 200, you don't want to be the person who says, well, if you read page 5, you'd know what was going on page 200. No, they're telling you, lay down some more breadcrumbs so I understand.
And
beta readers have been critical. And, of course, I write as a woman, a 20-something young woman. So most of my beta readers are young women who will tell me the truth about, I would never say that, or I've been in this situation and you nailed it. Beta readers can take you where you really need to go as a writer.
That's actually very good. Bobby?
Thank you.
Well, I was just going to say, and in this book, you deal with Me Too, and we have some situation. You bring a lot of, in little pieces, you bring, we know we're living contemporarily. And I would imagine that beta readers also become very important if you're touching on areas that you yourself are not an expert on, even if you've researched, you want it to sound like this is the way people would talk about this, I'm guessing.
Right.
So there's also that need as well in making it feel real.
Yes. In my book, Troubled Water, the third novel I wrote, their 911 calls play an important part. And one of my friends in Wisconsin, Karen Hull, used to train 911 operators. So I sent her chapters because I didn't know anything about 911. And so her feedback was fabulous because she said, well, we don't know how to do this. This isn't right. But one situation that I created, she said, I've been in that situation. And it's basically one of those situations where a woman is in trouble. She calls 911, but she can't let the bad guy know that she's on the phone to 911. And so my friend Karen said that you've got to be alert as a 911 operator so that if you sense that the woman is in danger, you've got to ask yes-no questions so that the person will be able to tell. So, you know, and so the 911 operator would say, are you in trouble, ma'am? Why, yes, I'll have anchovies on that pizza, you know. And so with yes-no questions, they can find out, does the guy have a gun? Where are you? Or, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right,
and she's been in that situation. And I just imagined it, and I guessed right.
Yeah.
But it was confirmed with an actual 911 operator.
Okay.
You have Lark journaling, and in that segment that you read aloud, she was journaling at the table. And I have a sense that you also journal. Is that
like
something that you do?
Oh,
like
my
a fiend.
God.
So we have a really
working.
Yeah, that talk a little bit about that, because I would think some writers, or they don't even know where to get started. Maybe the power of journaling. Why don't you talk about that a bit?
Well, journaling for me, I mean, I'm a journalist, so I suppose, duh, that's what journalists do. But for me, it's a way to sort things out. I think onto the page. And because I'm working on my memoir now, I'm going back to journals that I wrote in 25 years ago. I mean, I forgot a lot about that stuff. And it's been a real eye-opener to see the kinds of things I was wrestling with and to see how much I've changed or not. And so thinking, the exercise of journaling is a way, it's just a number of things that can be accomplished. It's a way to examine your life. It's a way to keep the pen moving so that, you know, you're scratching that writer itch, even though you may not be creating a story. And it's just a way to think on paper. So for me, journaling, I mean, I've worked through several grief situations when my son died, for instance. You know, journaling was, you know, not only the way I got through it, but it was what my grief counselor said. You know, she said, you don't need me anymore because what you do in your journal is what I do, and you pay me for. So I know the questions to ask myself, and that's what I think good journaling is. It's therapy. It's the willingness to be brutally honest with yourself about yourself, because I think good writing comes from a place of authenticity. Mm-hmm. And the better you know yourself, the better your writing will be, because it'll be coming from a real place.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll buy that. Are you a pantser or are you a outliner?
Yes. I tend to be a planner. I like to know where I'm going. But generally, I'm not as good a planner as I'd like to be, which means that when I'm writing the first draft, I usually come to a point where I realized, oh, hadn't thought about that, hadn't figured that out. When I was writing Fake, for the longest time, I was stuck in writer's block because I didn't know where I was going. And so I finally broke the log jam. But I wrote in the manuscript, in all caps, Russia does something provocative here.
Yeah.
And that enabled me then to write more of the story. And as I was writing it, I figured out, oh, Russia could do this. It's not Hillary's emails either. And so I figured that out. So by necessity, I have to also be a seat of the pantser.
Right.
And writing as a seat of the pantser is, for me, like sticking a straw into my subconscious. And it comes out because you're following your curiosity, and it's just spooky the way it comes from your subconscious through your fingers and onto the page. And so there's a certain degree of serendipity that I allow for as well. So I'm a planter.
Okay. Character development real quick, because we're going to have to take another break here in just a minute. But character development, you've obviously gotten to know Lark Chadwick very well in five novels. Do you find that as you're writing her, this is a question, Bobby knows what I'm going to ask. Do you find as you're writing her, does she tend to take you by the nose hairs and lead you down a rosy path and not where you intended to go?
I usually lead her down the path. I throw a lot of stuff at her. And so she and I have this love-hate relationship. You know, she wants to have an easy, peaceful life. And I'm a sadist, and I just try to throw stuff at her and see how she'll deal with that.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break to the writer's block, and we'll be right back with author John Dedekas right after this word from Creative Edge.
When Creative Edge was founded in 2016, they immediately showed they weren't going to be the same as other publicity firms. No, sir. You see, the folks at Creative Edge, they work closely with their individual clients, their needs, and their goals, pushing them harder and to get them noticed and get them booked. They believe communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is exactly how they have built their success. They work on the, I can do that better, and they have indeed done just that. They collaborate and work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet their clients' goals and needs. So Creative Edge, it's your brand, it's your future. Mickey Mickelson, publicist, and you can find them at creative-edge.services.
And we are back with author John Dedekas. It is now 6:45 Pacific time, and we are talking about his novel Lark, about things that he's done as a writer, what he likes as a writer, what he doesn't necessarily care for as a writer. And we have one question that we always ask every writer that comes on this show. John, we talked about this, and Bobby, hit him with the question.
I think you somewhat answered it, but what do you do when you get writer's block? Do you believe in it or not? If you do, how do you get through it?
Writer's block is definitely a real thing. It was a real thing for me, especially when I was a young reporter. I was working at a radio station in Madison, Wisconsin, and we had to do a newscast every hour. And for the life of me, I just kept hitting the wall. I had trouble, you know, getting that first sentence out. And I, in frustration, and this is a true story, the transmitter in the studio was out in the boonies in a cornfield. And I went outside and I prayed. I got on my knees and I said, Lord, help me to write well and fast. And it was almost like the prayer needed an editor, because it was like I was giving to God a deadline. You know, I want to write now. But I went back in and I was able to write smoothly and quickly ever since. Now, that doesn't mean that I still don't experience writer's block, but the counterintuitive answer to how do you get out of writer's block is to write. Because what I've discovered is that most writers who experience this, if you really analyze what's going on, it's fear. It's fear of not getting it right, making a mistake, being judged, whatever, rejection. And if you just accept it, those fears are normal and they're probably going to happen. But the first draft is just that steaming pile of clay that you'll then be able to remold. So don't worry about making mistakes on your first draft. Just get it out. And I think if you realize what you're afraid of and realize that it's not worth getting upset about, just write it, try it, and then you can always fix it.
There you go. Actually, I was going to say, as you were saying, steaming crock of, I was going to say owl guano, but then I opted not to.
obviously a good writer.
Well, you know, there's that famous line about fear, you know, you saddle up anyway. So in this case, it's you just write through it, you know, you get up and you write anyway.
the irony is that overcoming fear, you can't. Overcoming fear means you got to face it.
Right.
You know, it's like the guys that stormed the beaches of Normandy. Were they afraid? They were terrified.
Oh, absolutely.
They went forward anyway, and that's the definition of courage, fear in action, not the absence of fear.
So, well, look, we're out of time, John. Thank you so much for joining us. There's so much more we wanted to talk about. Will you come back and visit us again next year?
I'd love to. That means
we would love to have you when the new Lark book comes out. So
yeah.
Keep us in mind, if you would, please.
Thank you. This has been so much fun.
Oh, it's been a hoot having you, and you've been such a wonderful guest. The book is called, of course, Fake. Mr. Author John Dedekis. You can find him at just anywhere. You want to put the book Fake in on Google, and it'll bring up about 25 websites that the book's available at. So, and you have a email, and you also have a website, John. You want to say what that is?
Yeah, the website is probably the best way to get through to me, and I've got one of these tricky Greek names, so I'll spell it for you.
Okay.
The first name is not Greek, but I'll spell that too. My website is johndedekis.com. So that's J-O-H-N, D as in dog, E, D as in dog, A, K as in K, I-S as in Sam, .com. Dedekis, johndedekis.com.
Okay. And again, thank you so much for joining us. And again, please do get a hold of the bookie. And you met her the other day. And we would love to have you back on the show. You've been a wonderful guest, and we do appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
It did. When you got a great guest, you look up and you go, holy crap, we're out of time. next week, we have a good friend. Stick around for a minute. Next week, we have a friend of the show, a good personal friend of mine. And his first initial foray into two books, they were fun to read. But his next one, I believe we're going to be getting them tomorrow from the bookie. It's Wayne Deal. And Wayne is he's a fun writer, and he's just got a lot of things to say. The Boy with No Name was actually one of my personal favorites. So. If you tune in next Tuesday and of course Thursday at 6 p.m. Pacific, and of course Thanksgiving we will be cold on our live set, but we will have a best of the writer's block for you. I'm going to let Bobby pick this one out this year.
Oh.
Maybe we'll replay yours, John. What do you think?
Yeah,
I think that's a good idea.
So anyway, okay, for Mr. Dedekis, Bobby Jean Bell, myself, my occasional co-host, Russ Davison, and, of course, Ronan Rosner and Sam Hassan for writers, our LA Talk Radio and the Writer's Block. We are out of here.